You're listening to Civic from the San Francisco Public Press. On this edition, hear the second half of our story about women who fought slavery in Chinatown around the turn of the 20th century.
What bound them together was that they were church women and they saw social injustice and they wanted to try to make a change. And so they set up a safe house on the edge of Chinatown, originally in an apartment, and then they kind of raised enough money to buy a home on Sacramento Street. Tian Fu Wu arrived at the home in about 1894. Tian was a very bright young woman and was one of the few who was able to attract a sponsor.
I'm Laura Wenis, and this is Civic. Welcome back to Civic. Let's get back to the story of how a group of women took on sex trafficking and slavery in Chinatown around the turn of the 20th century. I went to Chinatown with journalist Julia Flynn Seiler, author of The White Devil's Daughters, The Women Who Fought Slavery in San Francisco's Chinatown. We were there to visit the Cameron House, where these women once took rescued victims to try and keep them safe and help them build new lives.
So we're heading to 920 Sacramento Street, on the edge of Chinatown and right below the most exclusive neighborhood in San Francisco, Nob Hill. In fact, it's looked down on the house. You can look down on it from the roof of the University Club, and you can also see it directly from the Fairmont Hotel. So it's very, very close. It's an unusual building. It's kind of a stocky brick building, and a number of the bricks are clinker bricks, so they were these funny misshapen bricks that were salvaged after the 1906 firestorm. And, you know, it really hasn't changed very much since the house was rebuilt in 1907. So, you know, you might be surprised.
Okay, well, let's go see.
Okay, great.
Mission home at 920 Sacramento Street was very close to the Presbyterian Church, but it was also right down the street from the Chinese Western Daily, which is known as the Chungsa Yapo, founded by a Presbyterian clergyman named Ning Pun Chu, who ended up marrying a young woman from the mission home. And Ing Pun Chu became one of the biggest supporters of the home. He started his newspaper in 1901, right at the time that the bubonic plague was erupting in Chinatown. And he wrote about that and had a lot of the same concerns as the women of the mission home. He was, of course, against the trade in Asian girls for sex slavery, and wrote about that many times over the years. Okay, so here we are. You can hear the sounds of kids playing. And these are the bricks. So you can see how they're molten from the 1906 disaster, where it was an earthquake and then the fires that raged throughout the city and razed most of Chinatown.
So here against these bricks, there's this label here, the Donaldina Cameron House.
Yes, in Chinese and in English. Established 1874, Presbyterian Mission Home. And interestingly, you have that, the raised lettering above the steps leading to the front door. Occidental Board Presbyterian Mission House. The Occidental Board was the group of women we talked about earlier, the church women who saw the way that Asian women were being treated in the city and decided to found this as a safe house for them.
And where were these women coming from? So these sound like mostly women who were organizing through missionary societies. What were these missionary societies, and why were women the ones who were starting to take this initiative to help victims?
Mm-hmm. Well, these were church women. Sometimes they were the wives of missionaries who had been stationed in Chinatown. And the missionaries' wives, reflecting their husbands' goals, were very interested, of course, in converting Chinese women to Christianity by offering social services, in effect, offering them a safe place to flee to and to change their lives by going to a refuge. Now, some of the wider circle of women who supported this project through either donations or volunteering their time, they had a number of different motivations. Sometimes it was a social group. They wanted to be part of a group of women doing something good. Other times they were looking to find their own places in a kind of wild, open society of San Francisco at the time. They were newly arrived from the Midwest, and they wanted to find a place for themselves. So just like any humans, you know, motivations vary. But what bound them together was that they were church women, and they saw social injustice, and they wanted to try to make a change. And so they set up a safe house on the edge of Chinatown, originally in an apartment, and then they kind of raised enough money to buy a home on Sacramento Street. And they ran that home for almost six decades. And in the course of that project, which began, they opened the first refuge in 1874, in the course of that, they offered refuge or safe harbor to somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 girls and women in San Francisco, which is...
Wow.
Can you imagine the number of lives that they touched?
So you tell the story of the first time that you came here.
Yes.
In the book. You originally came here hearing that this was a haunted house.
Yes.
How did that lead to these 5 years of research, more than 5 years of research that you did to put together the book?
Well, initially I had been...
Let's step out of the way.
Sure. Initially, I'd been interested in maybe writing about a history of San Francisco. And in the course of my reading and research for that, I came across accounts saying 920 Sacramento Street was the most haunted house in the city. And I thought to myself, well, I want to learn more about this. And I quickly realized that I could tell a very vivid portion of San Francisco's history through this single building, which... passed through the Chinese Exclusion Act, passed through the bubonic plague outbreaks, went through the earthquake and firestorm of 1906, was rebuilt in 1907, and really hasn't changed very much since that time.
Cool. So now we're standing on the steps here. Has much changed about the structure of the building since women and girls passed through here trying to escape slavery?
No, almost nothing has changed. There was a earthquake retrofitting in the 70s, but still the main portion of the building, the exterior and even the interior, is very much the same. The doors, the big heavy wooden doors with the metal grating, those date back 100 years. They didn't change. So I think that's one of the great treasures of this building, and it kind of in itself encapsulates the history, this very vivid history of San Francisco. Okay.
Right.
Shall we enter? So it's always locked to this day. And just, thank you. And there's always a doorkeeper. There's been a doorkeeper since the beginning.
Hello.
This is my friend Laura.
Hello.
Very nice to meet you.
I'll just sign here. We're here for Mike. Yeah, thank you, Michael. So you see there's a mural on the walls that tells the history of the home. And I think this mural was painted in the 1940s, maybe. But there's some just wonderful episodes. You see Donaldina Cameron on the rooftop engaging in what she called rescue work at that time. You see the flames coming out of the building, 1906 earthquake.
So
see all the kids, which is fun.
My name is Yolanda Kwong, and I am the Director of Social Services Ministry. And today, Cameron House is a multi-service community and faith-based organization that's still affiliated with the Presbyterian Church of the USA. And today, we offer an array of different services, from empowering women and girls who are in domestic violence situations. We also offer families who have different situations and challenges, which we offer counseling. And also we have ESL and computer classes for adults, and even a cancer support group for cancer patients and their family members. But besides the social services department, of course, we have our youth department as well. So many different services offered to young children from elementary school, middle school to high schoolers, and even sometimes young adults as well. Different leadership, mentorship programs, after-school program, and three different summer programs, as well as a full week of camp as well. So hopefully to provide linguistically, culturally appropriate services for the community, especially many different immigrant families or families who do not have resources, who want to come to a place, a safe place they can call a second home, and be able to build and strengthen their lives so that they can continue to be self-sufficient in this community and for many generations to come as well.
And while we're here, would you mind telling me again, where are we standing right now? What part of the house are we in?
This is known as the parlor room. It's on the ground floor. And this is where if a young woman or a girl was seeking refuge, she would first sit down and talk with the superintendent of the home or one of the staffers to find out what her situation was.
Great. Would you mind if we went and saw whatever last thing she wants to show me?
Yeah.
I heard tunnels, and I'm intrigued.
Right. Well, not plural, really.
Just tunnels?
This is an urban myth.
Either way,
I'm
intrigued.
I can't tell you how many people ask me about this. I probably need to every time. Or else people tell me about the tunnels.
Wow, restricted area. I'm getting special access here.
Okay. It's exciting.
Sorry, it's kind of messy because we have camping trips coming up. Where do you think the tunnel's at?
What? I don't even know where we're at.
We're in the basement. We're a five-story building, so this is basement. And the floor that you came in from is actually the third floor. We call it the third floor. Yeah.
Okay.
So this is actually the basement.
And there's a tunnel here.
And there's a tunnel. It's a famous tunnel where Ms. Cameron and her staff would take or lead the girls through this tunnel, because when the snakeheads or the masters came knocking on our doors to try to take the girls back, back in the days, Ms. Cameron and her staff would take these girls and lead them through this tunnel, which we heard it leads into Chinatown so that they can escape from their owners.
Wow. Yeah, I don't even know where to start guessing where it might be.
It's right here, right behind the cupboards.
Wow. Yeah, imagine having to escape through there in a hurry under duress.
I've been in here myself before. Yeah, of course, in the 21st century. But, I actually taught a Chinese-American history class here at Cameron House. Initially, I wanted to be a teacher, so I wanted to get some experience and say, hey, why not teach here at Cameron House for one summer? And so I go, wow, what's a better place to teach the children about Chinese-American history, than this place, right, where they're at? And so I took them down for a field trip, and here we are. We have the tunnel down here in the basement. And I went in there myself just to see what it was like. And you have to kind of go through the pipes and you can stand up. But it's really dark and the ceiling is really low as you get further down. But there's a cement wall that blocks it off now, because who knows, there's an exit, there's an entrance. We don't want people to come in, through those other ways. And so, but just kind of imagining back in the days while you're running for your lives, Just going into this tunnel, just being very dark, very claustrophobic, and just don't know where, you know, it may end or where your life will be at in the next second. So,
what about the women who were rescued? What role and what say did they have after they escaped or were taken from their captors?
Yes, so they would come to the home, and the home was very regimented. Not the early days when it was a little wild, but when the home finally found a superintendent who was very skillful, she ran a well-ordered home, and everyone was on a schedule. We'd get up at 7 in the morning. Everyone would do chores. There would be prayers every morning. There was education. In some cases, these girls and women, this is the first formal education they ever got. There would be 3 meals a day. There on Sundays, they would go to church, and they would be escorted from the home to church because of the fear that traffickers would try to snatch them back off the streets.
Wow. Yeah, there's also a moment in the book early on where one of the girls notices bars on the windows, and you write, well, they weren't there to keep the women inside from escaping. They're there to keep the traffickers out so they don't come back and reclaim what they saw as their property.
Yes.
I mean, this is just like, it makes me feel like, was there ever really an escape from this? Once you're in it, I mean, are you just forever pursued by traffickers?
Well, one of the options that a number of the women, once they reached the home, concluded was the best option was to marry out of the home. And Chinese men across the country knew that there were single women at this home. And so it became kind of a de facto marriage bureau. Men would come, they would meet young women there, and they would essentially negotiate with the staffers at the home who wanted to make sure that they were good men, they were not criminals, and they would take care of these women and girls. And so, you know, the remarkable thing I learned was that there is now a diaspora of Chinese-American families across the country whose grandmothers came through this house.
The legacy of matchmaking at Cameron House was part of the Reverend Harry Chuck's family history. He's a civil rights leader in the Chinatown community. Reverend Chuck described his grandmother and mother's life in their home during a panel discussion on the book, White Devil's Daughters, hosted by the Chinese Historical Society of America. Here's what he had to say.
By the time the earthquake took place, my mother was 6 years of age, and, you know, her mother had been matched by the staff here. They did a lot of matchmaking here. So all that stuff you find on the internet, that's not new. they wanted the girls who came under their care to, you know, find someone respectable, someone who would protect them and support them. And of course, the girls never completely separated themselves out from the mission. They would they would keep coming back and to visit Dolly because, you know, they called her mother, and she was really a surrogate mother for many of the girls. So my mom enjoyed running around through this building, and it really wasn't until I was in high school that I realized that I had this strong historical connection here.
Reverend Chuck went on to become the executive director of Cameron House and a member of the San Francisco Housing Commission. While some of the women who passed through the Cameron House moved on to focus on their married lives, others decided to join the work against sex trafficking. We'll learn more about Cameron House and talk more with the author of White Devil's Daughters, Julia Flynn Seiler, in a moment. You're listening to Civic from the San Francisco Public Press.
The San Francisco Public Press and KSFP rely on support from readers and listeners like you. That's why we're excited to participate in Newsmatch, a national collaboration of journalism funders. NewsMatch will double donations from individuals to the public press through the end of the year. Your pledge will support independent, diverse local perspectives and investigative reporting. Visit sfpublicpress.org/donate.
This is KSFP LP, San Francisco.
Yeah, I want to talk about two important characters in these stories. One of them is Dolly Cameron, the daughter of a Scottish sheep rancher, and Tian Fu Wu, am I saying that right?
Mm-hmm.
A Chinese girl whose father sold her to pay off gambling debts. And she was a child slave in San Francisco's Chinatown. They both ended up in the same place, but they didn't start off seeing eye to eye. And that relationship really changed over time. Can you talk about these two women and how they worked together?
Yes. So Tian Fu Wu arrived at the home in about 1894. And she was about a generation younger than Dolly. She could have been Dolly's daughter. And she was such a lively, interesting girl. We know this because we have firsthand accounts from her of her life in the home, including recordings. She didn't die until the 1970s. So, you know, we have her own words about what it was like to grow up in the home. And Dolly arrived about 15 months later or so in 1895. Actually, that would have been about a year later in 1895. And she had joined the home as a sewing teacher and quickly realized that her responsibilities were going to entail a lot more than teaching young girls and women how to stitch properly. She realized that this home was filled with young women who'd been abused and were traumatized, and she was going to have to really call on many other skills and emotions to work there. And so anyways, Tian and Dolly met each other. One of the first times they met, Tian had stolen some apples and ended up confessing to this to Dolly. And on her, you know, close to her deathbed, Dolly died in the 1960s. She made a recording about talking about Tian, and she recalled her as being, you know, an incredibly honest young girl and person all her life. And it's so poignant because they worked together for decades, as it turned out, and they became each other's really closest friends. Tian is buried in the Cameron family plot in Evergreen Cemetery in Los Angeles.
What kind of work were they doing together? Because I'm interested in hearing more about these women who came in as victims and ended up contributing to the work there and shaping the way that the work there was done.
Sure. So Tian had been carried to the home in the arms of a policeman, and she had been badly abused. She had burns on her arms from her owner having essentially tortured her. So Tian was a very bright young woman and was one of the few who was able to attract a sponsor. There was a Presbyterian man who agreed. He lived in a different city, but he agreed to pay for her to go to a very good boarding school in the Philadelphia area and then on to college in Toronto. So she had an extraordinary journey across the country and then back again. And she ended up making the decision to join the home as a staffer, in part because it really was the only family she ever knew. She did at some point try to go back to China. She did go back to China looking for her own biological family, and she could not find them. So she felt that she owed something to the home, which had provided her with an education and really saved her from a desperate fate. Many of the child slaves at the time, the Mutsi, which is what they were known as, would become prostitutes as they came of age. And she undoubtedly knew that her fate was changed by the day when she was rescued by that policeman.
And then what role did she end up playing at the home?
Sure. So she played a number of different roles. She was extremely important to the functioning of the home. She was not only a translator who could speak to the women and girls who spoke only Chinese, and it's very important to note that the superintendents of the home generally did not speak Chinese. So she was the intermediary between the white women who ran and financed this home and the girls and women who took refuge there. She was quite a stern taskmaster, so she would organize chores, she'd organize the girls. She at one point escorted several women on a trip back to China. She was a very, very competent person in a number of different ways. She was highly respected by the immigration authorities. She would do translation work for them as well.
One of Donaldina Cameron's descendants shared her memories of her great-aunt, Donaldina, and of Tianfu Wu at a panel discussion at Cameron House, hosted by the Chinese Historical Society of America.
I am the grandniece of Donaldina Cameron, and I think she must have been almost 80 when I was born. We did live in the same part of Palo Alto. She'd retired down there. So I heard a lot about her life. We'd go over to her house for birthdays and Christmases and other events, so we saw quite a lot of her. She told stories. She told stories about, you know, the 1906 earthquake and about, you know, her life. She told stories about, you know, her life in this area. And, you know, it was interesting, but, you know, she was very elderly, but very kind. She loved children and was very nice to us. And I guess, you know, I knew a little bit about a Cameron House. We had pictures of my dad sitting on the front steps out here when he was a little boy. So I knew a bit about it and came here maybe once or twice, but didn't know in detail about, you know, all the things she did until I grew up and you know, learned more. Right next door, she lived in a white house. Right next door was a smaller house, and that's where Teen lived, Teen Wu. And she was just another aunt to me. You're a little kid, you don't know the difference. So they were both my aunts. And Teen was wonderful. She taught us to count in Chinese. She gave us chopsticks and taught us how to use them. She was, a wonderful aunt as well.
Catherine Cameron grew up to become a professor of archaeology at the University of Colorado Boulder. Her most recent book, Captives: How Stolen People Changed the World, is dedicated to Tianfu Wu, whom she knew as Auntie Wu.
I'll have to edit myself because this is a subject that's I've been studying for about 15 years, but I started looking at captive women as being a sort of a vector for bringing in new ideas into societies. And when you start looking around the world, you find that young women are taken captive everywhere you look. And I was looking mostly at small-scale societies like, you know, the tribes of the Northwest Coast, the tribes of the Southeast, South America, even Europe. It was very, very common. And so this is, you know, what was going on here was a piece of this bigger view. One thing that startles me is that the statistic is that 200 years ago, 3/4 of the world's people were slaves, serfs, or indentured servants, and now it is way less than 1%. Still, you know, I'd always known that that's what my Aunt Dolly did for a living, and it was so, you know, interesting to sort of look around the world and see how it fit into this larger picture of captive taking.
Professor Cameron's ongoing work is a reminder that the work of her great aunt and women like Tianfu Wu isn't just part of history. 21st century activists and advocates continue to fight sex trafficking and other forms of modern slavery today. Special thanks to Cameron House for allowing us to tour the building and share its history. Thanks also to the Chinese Historical Society of America for permission to air excerpts of their panel discussion on Julia Flynn Seiler's book, White Devil's Daughters. Learn more at chas.org. You can see the full conversation recorded by the Chinese Historical Society on the Donaldina Cameron House YouTube channel or the Cameron House website, cameronhouse.org. I'm Laura Wenis, and you've been listening to Civic.
Civic is a production of the San Francisco Public Press. Your host is Laura Wenis. Producer and contributor, Mel Baker. Thanks for listening.